Imagine going to the doctor for, high blood pressure or maybe early stage diabetes.
Right.
You sit on that crinkly paper on the exam table, just, waiting for the inevitable.
Oh, yeah, everyone knows that sound.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But instead of handing you a prescription bottle filled with, I don't know, manufactured pills, your doctor hands you a packet of tomato seeds, a trowel, and a map pointing to a vacant lot like three blocks from your house.
Which sounds completely absurd.
It does. It sounds like a strange piece of performance art or something. Because we are so conditioned to view medicine and public health as this very clinical, sterile, binary system.
Yeah, you're sick, you get a chemical intervention from a pharmacy, and you just hope the numbers on your blood tests go down.
Right. We expect health to be engineered.
And I mean, it is a comforting expectation. We're culturally trained to want solutions that are visible, categorized, and just neatly dispensed from a laboratory. You know, the medical model is entirely built on isolated variables.
But when you actually step into the reality of systemic nutrition or community health and behavioral shifts, that isolated model starts to look remarkably inadequate.
It really does.
We're looking at a diagnostic and intervention landscape that operates much more like an ecosystem than a machine. And today, being Saturday, June 27, 2026, we are right in the thick of prime summer growing season for a huge portion of the world.
It's the perfect time to talk about this.
Totally. So I want you, the listener, to picture a community garden in your own neighborhood.
Maybe it's a series of wooden raised beds on an old corner lot.
Yeah, or a patch of fenced-in green behind a local elementary school.
Yeah.
For a long time, society has treated these spaces as, I don't know, cute neighborhood hobbies.
Right, like a place for retirees to grow prize-winning squash.
Exactly. Or a scenic backdrop for a local news segment. But what if those wooden beds are actually a highly effective, deeply serious piece of public health infrastructure?
And that fundamental shift in perspective is the entire focus of the sources you provided for us to analyze today.
And it's a lot of material.
It is. I have to say, the stack of materials is exceptionally thorough. We're pulling from a really wide-ranging collection of peer-reviewed literature.
Like the systematic reviews from the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior.
Yes, and BMC Public Health and Sustainability Science. But we aren't just looking at the academic research, we are pairing that with hard government data.
Which is where it gets really grounded.
Exactly. We're looking at reports from the CDC stacks, the EPA's Brownfield Guidelines, and the USDA.
And for listeners who might not be familiar with all the bureaucratic alphabet soup, when we say USDA, we are talking about the United States Department of Agriculture,
Right.
and specifically their SNPED program, which we will definitely get into.
Precisely. And to ground all this theory in reality, we're also examining on the ground operational reports from university extension programs spanning the entire country.
Like the University of Minnesota and Illinois?
Yep, and Penn State, Georgia, and Michigan State, these are the institutions actually doing the, dirt under the fingernails work of implementing these programs.
The sheer volume of evidence is just staggering.
Yeah.
And our mission for this deep dive is to basically bypass the romanticized, idyllic version of gardening.
No more cute squash stories.
Exactly. We are going to explore the concrete, measurable role of community gardens in improving nutrition security, tackling food deserts, and boosting community well-being.
And perhaps more importantly, the logistics.
Yeah, we are going to get into the gritty, complicated logistics of making these spaces actually function safely. So, okay, let's break this down. Before we can evaluate how a garden changes a city or a neighborhood, we need to zoom in on the individual.
We have to.
What is literally happening on the dinner plates of the people who dig their hands into this soil?
Starting at the micro level is essential, because if an intervention fails to change the behavior of the individual participant, it has zero chance of scaling up to create a community-wide impact.
That makes total sense.
When we look across the systematic reviews in your sources, I'm looking specifically at the recent reviews and the foundational papers that have been tracking this for decades. The data presents a remarkably unified conclusion.
Which is?
People who participate in community gardening consume more fruits and vegetables. The baseline of their diet fundamentally shifts upward.
I read those summaries, and I
Yeah.
have to admit, my initial reaction was, well, a bit skeptical.
How so?
Thought, sure, they eat a few more cherry tomatoes while they're out pulling weeds.
Right, like a snack break.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the data out of the California Agriculture Study, the one looking at a project in San Jose, showed something wild.
It really did.
They reported that garden participants were able to literally double their vegetable intake, Double it.
Yeah, bringing them up to the daily recommended servings.
But I mean, was that self-reported data or did they actually track this rigorously? Because doubling your vegetable intake is a really profound dietary shift.
The skepticism is entirely warranted, but the methodology of these studies is rigorous. The researchers aren't just asking people, you know, hey, do you feel like you eat more greens?
Right.
They use validated dietary recall surveys and track consumption over a period of time. The San Jose study is a perfect example of how a relatively small spatial intervention, basically giving a family a localized plot to grow food, creates a disproportionate outcome in their kitchen.
And what were the exact numbers?
They found that participants were jumping from about 1.9 servings of vegetables a day to nearly 4 servings.
Wow. That is the difference between a high risk for cardiovascular disease and a stabilized health trajectory.
It really is.
But what is the actual mechanism here? Why does putting a seed in the ground change human behavior so drastically? It can't just be that the food is physically closer to their house.
Proximity is a factor, sure, but it's a pretty minor one compared to the behavioral psychology at play. The literature points heavily to a concept called seasonal eating.
Which is something our modern food system has completely eradicated.
Oh.
I mean, if I want a tomato in January in the middle of a blizzard, I can just go to the supermarket and buy one. It might taste like wet cardboard and have the texture of a mealy apple, but it's there. We expect absolute uniformity year-round.
And that uniformity separates us from the reality of food production. When you rely solely on a grocery store, food is just an abstraction.
Right.
But when you grow your own food, your diet is forced to align with harvest cycles. If you plant zucchini, you are going to have an overwhelming abundance of zucchini in July.
Oh, don't I know it.
You cannot ignore it or it will just rot on the vine.
I know this deeply. A few years ago, I decided to plant a single zucchini plant in a pot on my patio. Just one. I thought it'd be a fun little, you know, side project.
A classic mistake.
Truly. By August, I was eating zucchini bread, zucchini noodles, roasted zucchini, and giving it away to neighbors who started actively avoiding eye contact with me because they knew I was carrying more zucchini.
You practically held hostage by the harvest.
Exactly.
What's fascinating here is that exact phenomenon is what drives the dietary shift. You're adapting your palate, your recipe repertoire, and your daily routine to what the earth is currently providing.
So you're eating more vegetables simply because you have to deal with them.
Right. This cyclical engagement fundamentally breaks the reliance on processed, boxed, convenience foods. The American College of Sports Medicine, the ACSM, has a really interesting perspective on this in the sources.
What do they find?
They note that the cyclical eating heavily reduces what they classify as seasonal food insecurity.
I hadn't actually heard that term before. Seasonal food insecurity.
It refers to the fact that lower income households often face fluctuating budgets throughout the year.
Well, that makes sense. Like winter brings high heating bills.
Exactly, which cuts directly into the grocery budget. Summer might mean kids are out of school and not receiving subsidized school lunches, which again strains the household food budget.
So it's not a constant level of insecurity. It spikes based on the calendar.
Yes. And a summer and autumn garden harvest provides a huge influx of nutrient-dense calories exactly when the household budget might be experiencing one of those seasonal shocks.
That makes perfect sense. It also reminds me of a psychological bias that behavioral economists talk about, the IKEA effect.
Oh, I like this comparison.
Right. If you buy a cheap, pre-assembled end table from a big box store, you don't really care about it. If it gets scratched, whatever.
Yeah, it's disposable.
But if you buy a flat pack table and spend 4 hours on your living room floor, sweating and cursing with a tiny hex wrench to put it together, you suddenly cherish that table.
You built it.
Exactly. It holds disproportionate value to you. It seems like the exact same psychological principle applies to agriculture. You are much more likely to eat a bowl of kale if you spend 3 months watering it, weeding around it, and defending it from aphids.
The psychological investment is a thoroughly documented mechanism in the reviews. The act of participation creates a really powerful cognitive link between the physical effort and the nutritional reward.
You value the food more because of the labor.
Precisely. And what is particularly compelling in the data is the finding that this psychological shift happens even for occasional garden participants.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you don't have to be out there for 3 hours every single day to experience the cognitive shift. The mere act of tending the space, even occasionally, alters how you perceive the value of fresh produce.
Okay, so the person holding the trowel is eating more vegetables, but what about the rest of the family?
That's a crucial question.
Because it's great if one person is having a dietary awakening But if they go home and their spouse and kids are still eating frozen pizzas, the public health impact is super isolated. Does the literature show if this IKEA effect radiates outward?
It undeniably radiates outward. The data published in PubMed specifically focused on this household dynamic.
And what did they find?
The research looked at adults in urban households, where at least one member actively participated in a community garden. The data confirmed that fruit and vegetable intake increased for the entire household, not just the gardener.
How does that actually work in practice? I mean, if a teenager never sets foot in the garden, why are they suddenly eating better?
Because the garden alters the daily food environment of the home.
Oh, because the food is just physically there.
Right. The person doing the gardening brings the harvest into the kitchen. The presence of that fresh, perishable food on the counter alters the grocery shopping list for the week.
You don't buy frozen spinach if you have fresh spinach sitting on the island.
Exactly. The primary cook is now incorporating those ingredients into dinner. The environment dictates the choices. If there is a huge bowl of fresh, sweet cherry tomatoes on the kitchen counter that a parent proudly grew, a teenager walking by is highly likely to grab a handful as a snack.
Instead of opening the pantry for chips.
Yes. The entire family's baseline food habits shift simply because the immediate environment has been modified.
It's an environmental nudge. That is a really powerful ripple effect. But since we know these spaces fundamentally change the dietary trajectory of an individual household, we really need to pan the camera out.
To the community level.
Right. Because the sources you aggregated aren't just looking at isolated families. They are analyzing systemic neighborhood issues. If we're going to look at gardens as public health infrastructure, we have to talk about how they address structural inequality.
And specifically, the concept of food deserts.
Yes. To address that, we need to be very precise about what a food desert actually is.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and broader encyclopedic definitions, food deserts are geographic areas where residents lack easy, convenient access to grocery stores and affordable fresh produce.
And lack of access doesn't just mean it's a minor inconvenience.
No, it is a severe logistical barrier. In these areas, the local convenience store or gas station might sell processed snacks, sodas, and maybe a few highly oxidized, expensive apples.
If you're lucky.
Right. But finding a fresh, affordable bundle of spinach or root vegetables requires a long bus ride, often with multiple transfers, or a car trip that many residents simply do not have the resources to manage.
It's an infrastructure failure. The city has failed to incentivize or support retail environments that provide nutrition.
Yes, and that brings in the affordability factor, which is arguably even more critical than proximity.
I noticed the Sustainability Science paper and the ArcSynth paper really lean into the economics of this. You can't just talk about miles to a supermarket. You have to talk about cost per calorie.
The economics are the quiet engine driving food insecurity. The models specifically look at the affordability of nutrient-adequate diets. Fresh produce is notoriously expensive relative to its caloric density.
Which is a huge problem.
It is. If a family is on a severely restricted budget, buying a dollar menu hamburger provides significantly more immediate satiety and calories than spending that same dollar on a bell pepper.
The rational economic choice for a hungry family is often the processed calorie-dense option.
So even if a beautifully stocked organic grocery store opens up right in the middle of a food desert, if the produce is priced out of reach, it might as well be on the moon.
Exactly. It doesn't solve the problem at all.
But a community garden directly subverts that cost barrier. It allows a community to bypass the retail markup entirely. Let's look at the real-world operational models from the USDA SNEP-ED programs.
Just as a reminder, SNEP-ED stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program Education.
Right. It is the educational arm of what we traditionally call food stamps. There are heavily documented success stories of their garden programs in rural Alabama and in Page County, Virginia.
And these aren't just, you know, a government official dropping off a box of seeds and waving goodbye.
Far from it. These are highly structured interventions. They use the community gardens to create direct, localized, fresh food access, and then they pair that agricultural access with on-site cooking demonstrations.
That pairing seems vital. Because if you have grown up in a food desert and your diet has been largely restricted to boxed macaroni or fast food out of necessity, handing you a raw eggplant or a bunch of Swiss chard doesn't actually solve your hunger.
It just creates confusion.
Right. You need the knowledge transfer of how to process that raw ingredient.
And the Virginius RENAP Ed program explicitly does that. They combine the act of growing food with tastings and step-by-step nutrition lessons using the exact produce harvested that day.
They bridge the gap between pulling a plant out of the dirt and actually putting it on a fork?
Yes. They teach knife skills, basic roasting techniques, and how to use herbs instead of heavy sodium for flavor.
But this raises a major logistical question for me.
Mm-hmm.
Gardening, as we established earlier with the zucchini story, takes time. It takes physical energy.
It's labor.
Exactly. We are talking about communities where people might be working 2 or 3 minimum wage jobs just to keep the lights on. A single mother working a double shift does not have 4 hours on a Tuesday afternoon to go weed a raised bed, no matter how much she wants fresh spinach.
That's a very real limitation.
So how do gardens serve the people who have absolutely no time to participate?
That is where the literature introduces a really fascinating secondary infrastructure, the donation network.
Okay, tell me about that.
If we look at the emergency food system in the United States, community gardens are playing an increasingly vital role. University extension programs, specifically those detailed in the reports from Minnesota, Illinois, and Georgia, have organized models they call giving gardens.
What makes a giving garden different from just a standard community plot?
Intentional overproduction.
Ah, so they aren't just growing for themselves.
Right. These are community gardens or specific plots within a larger garden that are designed solely to generate surplus. They aren't growing delicate heirloom tomatoes that bruise easily.
They're growing the sturdy stuff.
They cultivate crops that yield heavily, travel well, and have a longer shelf life. Things like butternut squash, potatoes, carrots, and hearty greens like kale and collards.
And the volunteers running these plots just funnel that surplus directly into local food pantries.
Yes. And this addresses a massive historical flaw in the emergency food system.
Because pantries mostly have canned goods.
Traditional food banks and neighborhood pantries rely almost entirely on shelf-stable processed items. Canned soups, boxed pasta, peanut butter, things that can sit in a hot warehouse for 6 months without degrading.
Which, to be fair, is important.
Absolutely. While those items provide absolutely necessary calories to keep people from starving, they are routinely high in sodium, high in preservatives, and practically void of fresh micronutrients.
You can survive on them, but you can't thrive on them.
The giving gardens inject fresh, locally grown vitamins directly into that emergency pipeline. The Illinois Extension reports detail entire regional networks of these gardens coordinating their planting schedules.
Like staggering the crops.
Exactly, to ensure local pantries have a steady, diverse stream of fresh food throughout the entire growing season. It transforms the food pantry from a place of last resort for boxed calories into a hub for fresh, vibrant produce.
That is a brilliant logistical workaround.
Mm.
But I want to pause here, though, because we have been painting a very optimistic, solutions-oriented picture.
And it isn't all perfect.
No. Here's where it gets really interesting. There is a study in the sources that threw a wrench in my thinking. It is the CDC STAC study analyzing the sociology behind this.
Ah, yes.
The framing study.
It challenges this purely positive narrative and asks a really uncomfortable question. Do community gardens actually appeal to diverse populations, or do they carry hidden biases?
It is a crucial piece of critical sociology. They look not at the agricultural output, but at the rhetoric and framing of food access.
Right.
How do these garden organizations, particularly those started by nonprofits or outside municipal agencies, talk about themselves, their missions, and the communities they're supposedly serving?
Because the default assumption is that a garden is inherently welcoming. I mean, it's plants, sunshine, and dirt. Who could possibly feel alienated by a carrot?
You'd think everyone would just be happy it's there.
But the analysis shows that the actual language and framing used in grant proposals, on welcome signs, and in community outreach matters deeply.
It really does. They found that if a garden's promotional language focuses heavily on highly individualized notions of self-empowerment, you know, the idea that you just need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and grow your own food, it carries heavy unintended baggage.
It places the burden of the systemic failure directly onto the victim of that failure.
Exactly. The implication in that empowerment framing is that if a family is food insecure, it is because they simply haven't empowered themselves enough to take control of their diet.
It inadvertently implies a moral failing, a lack of work ethic, or a lack of knowledge on the part of the food insecure person.
Which is incredibly condescending. It completely ignores the fact that the city zoned all the grocery stores away, or that the federal government subsidizes commodity corn instead of broccoli, which drives up the price of fresh food.
And when a community garden uses that rhetoric, even unconsciously, it alienates the very people facing unequal access.
Why would you want to go to a place that makes you feel bad?
Exactly. If the garden feels like a paternalistic project set up by outsiders to fix or educate a neighborhood, rather than a grassroots resource owned, operated, and directed by the residents themselves, participation plummets. People do not want to participate in a space that talks down to them.
The sources make it very clear that the rhetoric can either be an invitation or a wall. As we analyze this data, it's vital to recognize that just placing a garden in a marginalized neighborhood doesn't magically solve inequity if the power dynamics remain skewed.
We're simply relaying what the sociological data shows. The narrative of saving communities through gardening often backfires.
Because it's not actually addressing the root problem.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that tension ties directly into the physical, structural reality of where these gardens are located. I want to ask the listener to think about the community gardens they have seen. Who actually owns that land?
That's a great point.
The research from Loma Linda University highlights a fatal flaw in many of these initiatives. They point out that gardens require highly intentional, permanent policy and zoning support.
Because right now, a lot of them are just handshake agreements, right?
Mm-hmm.
The city has a vacant lot, it's collecting trash, so they let a neighborhood group put some raised beds on it to make it look nice.
Exactly. But you cannot achieve true food equity if the garden is just a temporary, precarious squatter's plot.
What happens when the neighborhood gentrifies slightly because the community worked hard to clean it up?
We've seen it happen. A developer swoops in, buys the vacant lot from the city, paves over the raised beds, and builds luxury condos.
And the community's labor is erased overnight.
Equitable land access requires municipal protection. Cities have to formally zone these areas for urban agriculture.
They have to decide that a garden is a permanent civic asset in the exact same category as a public library, a fire station, or a public park.
Yes.
But even if a city gets the zoning right and addresses the immediate food inequity for adults, we are really only treating the current generation.
Right, the adults.
Changing the long-term, generational trajectory of public health requires focusing on the youngest members of the community. We need to talk about kids and school gardens.
This is perhaps the most robustly researched and clinically validated area in your entire stack of sources.
Really?
Oh, the consensus regarding children is overwhelming. We are looking at reports from the Community Preventive Services Task Force, foundational studies in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, and comprehensive reviews in BMC Public Health.
And they all say the same thing.
They all point to the exact same irrefutable conclusion. School gardening increases children's vegetable consumption.
Which, if you have ever tried to feed a seven-year-old, sounds like literal magic.
It really does.
Getting kids to willingly eat vegetables is historically one of the great exhausting battles of parenting. It usually involves bribery, hiding spinach in smoothies, or standoff negotiations at the dinner table.
Just eat three more bites of peas.
Yeah. Exactly. But the USDA Farm to School Resources, and specifically the Nutrition to Grow On curriculum developed by the University of Minnesota Extension for upper elementary students, show that voluntary consumption is entirely possible.
It's proven.
The question is how? Why does this work so much better than just putting a side of steamed, mushy broccoli on a styrofoam cafeteria tray and telling them it's good for them?
The literature insists on a very specific two-pronged formula. Simply throwing kids outside to play in the mud and plant a few seeds is not enough.
That's just recess.
That is recreation, not intervention. The dietary shift, clinically speaking, only happens when experiential, hands-on growing is explicitly and immediately paired with formal nutrition education.
It has to be a combined curriculum.
Exactly. You teach the children in the classroom about plant biology, you explain what a vitamin is, how fiber moves through the human digestive system, and why leaves need sunlight.
The textbook stuff.
And then you immediately take them outside to the school garden to observe, measure, and harvest the very plant they just studied. The physical act of harvesting cements the academic extraction.
I look at school gardens as the Trojan horse of nutrition.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
You simply cannot lecture a third grader into liking kale. If a teacher stands at the front of a room and talks about antioxidants and long-term cardiovascular health, the kid's eyes will glaze over immediately.
Naturally.
But if you mask that exact same lesson as a messy outdoor science experiment, if you say, today we are going to dig in the dirt, catalog worms, and see what happens when we pull this weird purple root out of the soil, suddenly they are fully engaged.
They are scientists.
Yes. And they end up eating the purple carrot voluntarily because it was their personal scientific discovery.
It is a highly effective psychological strategy. The research validates that mechanism perfectly. The hands-on element breaks down a phenomenon called neophobia.
Neophobia being the fear of new things.
Specifically, the fear of new foods, which is an incredibly common, likely evolutionary trait in childhood.
Oh, sure. Kids are naturally suspicious of bitter, unfamiliar foods.
Yeah, but when a child plants a radish seed, waters it for weeks, and pulls it from the ground, the radish is no longer a strange, spicy red object imposed on them by a demanding adult.
It's their project.
It is their creation. Yeah. The ownership overrides the neophobia.
And it isn't just about the food. The Children in Nature Network research summary in your sources points out that this paired approach creates secondary benefits across the board.
The benefits radiate out.
It enhances academic performance in traditional science classes because they have real-world context for biology. It increases their daily physical activity, and it boosts psychosocial outcomes.
Yes. They have to practice patience waiting for seeds to sprout. They have to use teamwork to move soil or water large beds.
The psychosocial development is a huge component. However, a critical logistical question arises when we look at school interventions. The school environment is highly controlled.
It is.
But children only spend a fraction of their day there.
Right. The bell rings at 3:00 p.m. and they go home to a wide variety of different unregulated food environments.
So if a kid learns to love carrots at 1:00 p.m. in science class, does that actually matter if there were only potato chips and soda available at home at 6:00 p.m.?
That gap is where the bridging programs become essential. The CalFresh Fun with Seeds program, along with several of the University of Minnesota extension initiatives, are explicitly designed to cross that boundary between the schoolyard and the living room.
Oh, so they actively try to reach the parents.
Yes. They don't just keep the knowledge at school. They send seeds, child-friendly recipe cards, and interactive educational materials home in the students' backpacks.
The kids become the Trojan horse for the parents' diet.
Precisely. The goal is for the children to become the nutrition advocates within their own households.
I can see that working.
A child comes home buzzing with enthusiasm about a sugar snap pea they grew, and they say, "Look what I grew. We have to make this recipe."
Yeah.
It forces the parents to engage with the material.
The kids drive the behavioral change at the household level, which loops us right back to the household impact data we discussed at the very beginning of this deep dive.
It is an incredibly elegant closed loop.
The school garden changes the kid changes the household grocery list, the household diet improves.
Exactly.
But we have to pivot here, because everything we have discussed so far is the behavioral outcome.
The human element.
Right. We've established that gardens are phenomenally effective public health tools. But establishing a garden requires far more than just scattering some seeds, walking away, and hoping for rain.
The romantic ideal of a garden is often drastically different from the logistical reality on the ground.
Exactly. We need to get into the dirt on the logistics. Literally. Because setting one of these up is an intense undertaking.
This is where we transition from behavioral science and sociology into what is essentially civic engineering.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Establishing a functional community space is building infrastructure. And the literature on preventing chronic disease makes a definitive, non-negotiable point. Successful community gardens require dedicated garden coordinators.
Meaning someone actually has to be in charge. You can't just be an anarchic collective of people showing up whenever they feel like it.
No. The research found that leaving community gardens as informal, loosely organized plots almost inevitably leads to systemic failure.
Why is that?
When there is no central leadership, people lose interest. Weeds take over the pathways, interpersonal conflicts arise over who gets to harvest the tomatoes, or someone forgets to turn off the irrigation and floods a neighbor's plot.
So it just devolves into chaos.
Pretty much. To function as a reliable public health tool, gardens must be managed as structured health interventions.
So what does a garden coordinator actually do? Because I think people envision this job as just sitting on a bench in a sun hat, occasionally pointing at a watering can.
Not even close. The USDA SNF aid reports outline a grueling administrative and physical job.
It sounds like a lot of work.
It is essentially a nonprofit management position combined with agricultural labor. Coordinators manage complex volunteer schedules. They oversee crop rotation to ensure the soil isn't depleted.
Oh, right. Crop rotation is a whole science.
Exactly. And they have to mediate disputes between gardeners. They write grants for funding, secure municipal water rights, which can be a bureaucratic nightmare in many cities, and ensure that safety rules are meticulously followed.
The SNAPED reports even detailed the necessity of adapting this leadership training to virtual settings during crises, just to keep these coordinators trained and the program sustainable.
It requires heavy civic lifting.
And the logistics extend far beyond just managing people. The environmental safety concerns are severe. When we talk about urban community gardens, we are very often talking about converting vacant lot spaces that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, classifies as brownfields.
The EPA Brownfields and Urban Agriculture Guidelines, which were a key piece of your source material, are very blunt about the hidden chemical dangers here.
Because a vacant lot in the middle of a dense city wasn't always just an empty field of grass.
Rarely.
50 years ago, it might have been a gas station with leaking underground tanks. It might have been a dry cleaner using harsh solvents, or an industrial dumping ground for a manufacturing plant.
Exactly. Converting these blighted lots into green spaces has profound mental health and community benefits, but the soil chemistry is absolutely paramount.
What are we actually worried about in the soil?
Urban soil is routinely contaminated with high levels of lead, heavy metals, petroleum byproducts, and asbestos. The EPA guidelines mandate that these sites must be rigorously tested and the soil mitigated before a single food crop is planted.
What happens if you don't? Say a community group just goes rogue, breaks up the concrete, and plants a bunch of carrots in contaminated urban dirt.
That is a public health disaster. You have to understand the botany of how plants interact with toxins.
Okay.
Root vegetables like carrots, beets, and radishes grow directly in the soil and will readily absorb heavy metals like lead right into their tissue.
Wait, so the plant acts like a sponge for the pollution?
It's a process called phytoremediation. Certain plants are actually used intentionally to pull toxins out of the ground to clean it.
Oh, I've heard of that. Using sunflowers to clean up radiation or something.
Exactly. But if a human then eats that carrot, they are directly ingesting concentrated heavy metals, which causes severe neurological damage, particularly in children.
That is terrifying.
Interestingly, fruiting plants like tomatoes or peppers are generally safer because the heavy metals rarely travel all the way up the vascular system of the plant into the fruit, but the risk is still way too high.
So how do you mitigate it? You can't just scoop out an entire city block of dirt.
No, you utilize physical barriers and raised beds. The EPA requires laying down impermeable geotextile fabrics over the contaminated soil.
So the roots can't go down into the bad stuff.
Right. Then building tall wooden or metal beds and bringing in hundreds of cubic yards of clean, tested, imported soil from off-site. It is a major, expensive construction project before a single seed goes in.
And the safety logistics don't stop at the soil chemistry. Once the clean dirt is in, you have biological safety to consider.
Right, the pathogens.
The USDA guidelines for schools and the highly specific Penn State Extension guidelines focus heavily on food safety handling and the use of fertilizers.
Specifically, the use of manure. Penn State has an entire publication dedicated to the safe use of manure in home and community vegetable gardens.
Why is manure such a big deal?
Because these gardens are shared spaces, very often populated by novice volunteers who do not have formal agricultural training, there is a high risk of bacterial cross-contamination.
Right, because people think manure is just natural fertilizer. You buy a bag, you throw it on the plants, and they grow bigger.
But if raw or improperly incompletely composted manure is applied directly to the soil where food is growing, you introduce pathogens. You risk severe outbreaks of E. coli, Salmonella, or Listeria.
Which defeats the whole purpose of a public health intervention.
When you are growing food that will be shared among multiple families or donated to a local food pantry's emergency system, strict food safety protocols are not optional. You have to know the exact temperature your compost reached to ensure pathogens were killed. It is a public health necessity.
So what does this all mean? To summarize the logistical reality, you have to run chemical assays for lead, build physical barriers, import clean soil, train dozens of volunteers, write grants to secure funding, navigate archaic city zoning laws, mediate neighborhood disputes, and ensure nobody is accidentally spreading E. coli on the lettuce going to the food bank.
It is a staggering amount of invisible labor.
It's basically running a mini municipality. Which brings us back to the policy level. If a city recognizes how much work goes into this and how fragile these systems are, how should they view these spaces?
This raises an important question regarding municipal planning. The data suggests they must view them as permanent, critical infrastructure.
Not just a cute pop-up.
Right. Are these gardens just temporary placeholders to make a blighted neighborhood look appealing until a real estate developer comes along with a lucrative offer? Or are they permanent municipal assets supported by health departments, protected by zoning laws, and funded with the same reliability as a public utility?
Because if the clinical data shows that these spaces drastically improve public health, lower seasonal food insecurity, and alter the dietary habits of entire generations of children, they shouldn't be left to the whim of the commercial real estate market.
Exactly. The Loma Linda research drives this home. For community gardens to be a viable long-term approach to food equity, the policy supports have to be cemented in law.
So where does that leave us?
If we synthesize the core journey of all these diverse sources, from the behavioral psychology to the soil chemistry, the overarching picture is undeniably clear.
Community gardens are not just quaint, recreational places to grow a few tomatoes.
No. When they are backed by strong leadership, rigorous environmental safety protocols, and municipal support, they are dynamic, highly effective public health tools.
They literally double vegetable intake for participants.
They funnel fresh, nutrient-dense produce directly into emergency food systems that desperately need it.
They teach children lifelong dietary habits through hands-on experiential learning.
And they build vital social capital in neighborhoods that have been structurally deprived of resources.
They are a multi-tool for community well-being. And so, to you listening right now, whether you are prepping for a city council meeting to argue for permanent zoning protections, or you're looking to revitalize a vacant lot in your own neighborhood.
Or maybe you are just a parent trying to figure out how to get your own kids to eat more greens without a nightly argument.
Right. The evidence across all these studies is clear. The solution might just be outside, in the dirt, waiting to be cultivated.
The measurable impacts on human diet, mental health, and community resilience are all thoroughly validated in the data, provided we are willing to put in the logistical and political work to support them.
Which leaves me with a final, slightly provocative thought for you to mull over as we wrap up this deep dive. We spent this entire time looking at the clinical data.
We have.
We know that a community garden plot is as effective, and in some cases of long-term behavioral change, more effective at improving dietary health and preventing chronic illness than many traditional pharmaceutical medical interventions.
The data supports that.
So if the data is truly this strong, should doctors be able to literally prescribe a community garden space to their patients?
That would be a paradigm shift.
And if they do, should our health insurance systems start covering the cost of the seeds, the clean imported soil, and the salaries of the garden coordinators who make it all happen?
It makes economic sense if it prevents chronic disease.
If we treat it like medicine, maybe we should fund it like medicine. Something to think about next time you walk past those sunflowers growing on the chain link fence.